Ray. Hello.
Hello, Jordan.
Hi, I'm on speakerphone, and there's something that you wanted to tell me and our listeners about, so I'm all ears.
Okay, so April 4th, 7:30, To the White Sea is holding a screening at the Dunn Kunsthal Gallery in downtown Manhattan at 64 Fulton Street. Our guest next week on the show is artist and filmmaker Zee Beal. Zee is going to be showing a new film in the gallery, and then we're going to do a Q&A afterwards. Any of our listeners in the New York City area, please, you're super invited to come to the screening and be a part of the Q&A.
That's so awesome. I can't wait to bring this podcast into the real world. Yeah, and we'll watch our good friend Z's short film, and it'll be awesome.
I cannot wait.
Hell yeah.
The film opens on a U.S. Air Force base on Tinian Island, and a general tells a bunch of airmen that they're going to firebomb Tokyo tomorrow night, but tonight they're going out to do a normal bombing. And then we meet one of the gunners. We meet a tail gunner on a B-52. We see him getting his guns ready and then putting a bunch of modified weapons and modified other aspects of his ship. And then two young recruits come up to him and they basically, hey, I'm bigger than you. What's going on? He says, hey, let's bet $20 on this weird pull-up thing that I can do and you can't do.
On the dot. Great job.
Did it follow through all the way?
Yeah. And anyway, that was the first time we've tried with the timer, right?
Before there was so lit, that's the first time I felt the crunch.
Yeah.
All right, on to the theater of the mind. To the White Sea, episode 4, pages 7 and 8.
The big man knits his brow, unsure where this is going.
Go on. Try it.
Arlen jumps up, catches the brace but can't hold, and falls back down to the floor.
No grip. No grip, no guts, that's what they say.
Muldrow hops off the bunk.
Stand clear.
He jumps. He catches the brace with one hand in the pinch grip and swings from it. He adjusts, getting both hands on the board.
Now watch.
He has stopped swinging. He chins quickly up, lowers himself slowly, and then chins slowly and gracefully two more times. Muldrow drops to the floor and turns to face the big man, extending his hand.
Shake.
The big man hesitates.
Come on. Shake.
I don't think so. That grip you got there might not be too much left.
Yeah, a few bone splinters, maybe. I could use those. You can sew with them.
Arlen furrows his brow and shifts uneasily.
I ain't got you 20.
Uh-huh.
Muldrow turns back to the bunk, and the big man shuffles away, leaving the redhead staring at Muldrow's back.
I've been assigned to your crew, Muldrow. I never have to ask anybody but once who the best gunner in the squadron is. They all say you don't fly with them. They fly with you. It's a damned honor. I'm fucked if it's not.
On the bunk, Muldrow is sorting through things from an emergency kit. He ignores the redhead.
Can I ask you one thing, Sergeant? Just one.
I guess. What is it?
This is my first time out. You got anything special you can clue me in on?
Muldrow turns finally to face the kid, holding two small stones in his hand.
Nothing special. Don't waste your ammo. Never fire at anything out of panic. Make it count. That's all.
That's all?
You'll be all right. You just get up there and do what you know. get them fighters on the pursuit curve and let them slide on down the string just like they showed you in gunnery school. Even if you can see them, don't shoot first. Because that means they can see you too. Keep the selfie with that 50 caliber, and the Major will get you on back here. That's a fact.
What are those in your hand? Some kind of lucky stones?
They might be lucky down the road. They're flints to make fire.
To the white sea, to the white sea. Of all the things I'd like to see, to the white sea is the one I cannot.
What's your reaction to these pages?
I was pretty sure that Muldrow was going to win, for one thing. I was pretty sure he was going to do something cool with that pinch grip. I think I did say that he might beat Arlen's ass, which didn't happen. But in a way, he truly shut that guy down.
And so what was it exactly? Can you explain to me what the... He basically did a one-handed...
I don't think it's one-handed. I think he's holding on to the bar. Like, he doesn't have his full hand around the bar. He's doing a chin-up just with, like, pinching the bar.
Can you read the description of... Is it exactly... Does Arlen do the exact same thing that Muldrow does?
So Arlen already did the regular chin-up. And then he tries to catch it with a pinch grip, and he can't.
Okay, so Arlen can't even get a hold.
He can't even, yeah.
So basically, Arlen demonstrates that he can do it really just holding on with his full, like, fists, like, full mitts around the brace.
Yeah. And Muldrow's like, no, do it like this. And he does it in a way that's just showing off a degree of strength, like, precise strength where the guy's like, I don't even want to shake your hand. And Muldrow's like, yeah, because if I shake your hand... I'm going to break your fucking hand into splinters.
Yeah, I will atomize it.
I'll turn it into bone shards as splintered as sewing needles, and then I'll use it to sew, which I could use later.
We've already seen him do, like, MacGyver modifications. This is the first time that he's calling out, I'm the kind of guy that knows how to take bone splinters and turn them into... sewing needles.
So we're like coalescing his MacGyver skills into physical strength. They're kind of becoming one and the same.
The stuff that he excels at, he goes all the way to 1,000.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, so he totally, like, the guy's like, I don't have your 20. Slinks off.
Like a balloon with all the air let out of it.
Mm-hmm. But they didn't come to blows. But again, I mean, not to go back too much to last week's theme, which was sort of thoroughly exhausted, but I think this is a similar pattern, a softening of the big guy.
Yeah, much less he doesn't even want to fight him. He doesn't even want to shake his hand. And he admits that he's broke. Yeah.
Total lower status. Like, he commits to lower status.
Completely. Yeah.
He submits.
And then his little buddy, you know, just confides to Muldrow exactly how big his reputation is, and that he's looking to him for some kind of guidance or security or something to anchor to.
Yeah. And it's a totally different relationship. I mean, it's very much like the squirt in the Western.
Yeah.
Like the young kid who's eager to learn, probably has some skills lacking.
Yeah. Because these are both recruits. It's just Arlen with the big snake tattoo is just like he's bigger, stronger, but still a kid. His red is... Anyway, he's a teenager.
Yeah.
And he's probably talking to... I mean, I'm not sure. Did they say how old Muldrow is? They don't, right? They describe him as being a boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you'd have to imagine he's, like, in his early 20s. I mean, this was going to be Brad Pitt. Like, in the movie version, this is always going to be cast with Brad Pitt in, like, Troy, Mr. and Mrs. Smith era, which I don't exactly know how old he was, if he's like still in his 20s or is he in early
30s. He's in his 30s, but he would have been able to, like, you know, slim down, like, kind of look young somehow. I mean, this is like after Fight Club, though. Probably be pushing it in terms of like the age of the character.
I don't think you'd ever be able to see Brad Pitt play the scene with another actor and go, this is a scene about like a 16-year-old talking to a 19-year-old.
No. You would have seen this as a scene of Tyler Durden talking to a
guy squirt. In his early 20s or something. Yeah. Maybe a little bit like the soldier folk singer in Llewyn Davis.
I almost feel like that guy would actually be too authoritative.
What about like the son in Serious Man? More like that with the red hair. It's kind of like the Ethan Coen doppelganger.
Yeah, in that ballpark. Like if that kid had a few more years on him,
yeah,
you could go with that.
Well, that dynamic I think would be really strong when you actually watch the film.
So what else is going on in the second part of the scene? Kid says it's an honor. Muldrow's still sorting through. I mean, he's still in prep mode, you know? Like he has action to kind of busy himself with. Like what he said about the bone fragments, he's like, I could use that for later. He's still digging through the kit, trying to find something else, ignoring the redhead. Says, don't waste your bullets. Again, just talking about like incredibly minute logistics of like, know how many bullets you have. Pulls out the two small stones, gives him a little bit of a refresher on like what he's already studied. He says, let them slide on down the string, which I think is interesting, just as an image. It's kind of like thread going through a needle.
Yeah, that's a piece of jargon and kind of like craft theory. Like I don't know what he's talking about. I assume it's something about aiming a gun while you're flying and something else is flying and what you have to compensate for and how you anticipate it, where the airplane is going to be versus where you're aiming.
Or just, yeah, knowing that the plane has a certain path that it's going to go down based on like its trajectory.
Right. And he's describing it, you know, like I'm imagining like a bead sliding down a string, but I can imagine from like camera operating, honestly, just yeah. Like anticipating move. But it's so poetically described that it's like, that's not connected to anything. I just like the image of something sliding down a string and knowing, like seeing that he's been tending to these giant guns and everyone's talking about how good he is at shooting things with the guns, you know?
It's the kind of thing where like, I don't know exactly what he's talking about, but I also get a very specific image. Like I know that he knows exactly what he's talking about.
It's flowy. The stuff that he's talking about is like restraint, like never do anything out of panic. Don't be wasteful. Make it count. These are really simplistic. The advice is not like highly technical or even as bloodthirsty as like what we heard coming from the opening monologue. It's like talking about string and kind of patience, you know.
The major will get you on back here. That's a fact.
Right. Certainty.
On some level, he's reassuring him. It's like a director reassuring an actor where you kind of have to go overboard and be like, promise you, we're going to get you there. Like you have a whole crew behind you.
Right. Your job is just to focus on like this task, imagining this string being like in harmony with the trajectory of these bullets in these airplanes. And then everything else, if you do that, you just can let go and this will carry you home.
It's interesting they don't give but we don't see the kid respond at all. We don't see how he takes it in. I would assume, I mean, just judging from the way the character's written, I would imagine the kid's just sort of nodding and being like trying to absorb it all, but also feeling a little bit overwhelmed by how much information is being put out there. But he just immediately switches to, what are those in your hand? Some kind of lucky stones. Muldrow says, they might be lucky down the road. They're flints to make fire.
Red's focus goes from asking for reassurance to being like, what are these things?
And it's interesting that Muldrow basically ends both scenes by being like, I could use that later.
Right. You're talking about the sewing?
The sewing needle and the flints, saying they might be lucky down the road. I could use that later.
Yeah.
He's presenting a projection of the future based on like something that's right here in his hand.
Yeah.
Which I think could be a good jumping off point to the presentation this week, if you wanted to jump right into that.
Absolutely, because we know that this guy, he's got a bread knife that's turned into a fighting weapon. We know that he can make sewing needles out of bones, and we know that he has rocks that he can use to make fire.
So we're setting up a lot of stuff.
Exactly.
And that's what I wanted to talk about in this episode, is the setup of the plot early on in a movie.
Exactly.
Which doesn't necessarily mean the very beginning of the movie, and it doesn't necessarily mean the inciting incident, so to speak, but what it does mean is a good movie has breadcrumbs.
Right.
That will pay off later. And when you watch the movie front to back, you don't necessarily know where those are going to go. But when someone says, these are Flint, they might be lucky down the road. A pretty good idea of the fact that that's like a signpost to the audience that like this plot is going somewhere and I've just set some things up. So we're going to talk about different ways that movies set things up.
If you want to watch these clips, just DM us and we'll send you a link to the Google Drive and you can watch them.
If one of our Google Drives gets shut down as a result, we'll know we've reached a certain critical mass of listenership.
Okay, so let's all get there together. Yeah. That'll be a great moment when we hit. We're going to try to put more of these clips on social media and stuff so everyone has an idea of exactly what we're looking at. But
yeah. First movie I chose was Raising Arizona, and this one's an easy one to describe because it's literally the beginning of the movie, frame one, until the opening titles. This opener is iconic. If they were pulling from something else, they advanced the game. Like rapid fire montage, scene after scene after scene, driven by voiceover, but not necessarily an opening monologue that introduces you to this whole world. Hi, Nicolas Cage's character introduces you to Ed, his sweetheart, introduces you to John Goodman and his buddy, the convenience store, three times. The concept of recidivism, cycles, characters kind of continually getting in their own way. It's a propulsive opener. And when those credits hit, you've had so much set up. And something else I want to say is that this is 20 pages of script for a 10-minute sequence. A lot of times people will show you a screenplay and they'll be like, no. First 20 pages, 10 minutes. This pulls it off. I think the other interesting thing is that no other Coen Brothers movie opens like this, even though it's an incredibly effective way to start a movie. I mean, since this movie came out in 87, we've had Goodfellas, Magnolia, Tenenbaums. You're a short film. Do you have anything to say about like the way that functions?
I'm super, super interested in this as just like powerhouse, barn burner, narration-based opening 10 to 15 to 20 minute chunks. Like, is there like a precedent for that before Raising Arizona? I know that like the opening of True Stories is a powerhouse, but that's, no, some of that is him on screen. Like, so, you know, it cuts between him doing narration over archival stuff and then he's driving around the car and narrating and he's walking in and out of the screen.
They're very similar movies in terms of like setting and John Goodman's involvement.
Yeah. I mean, the John Goodman overlap is like a lot. Yeah. Those are both early Revenge of the Nerds era Goodman prestige performances. They have the same energy. Yeah, completely. They're born of the kind of the same scene of filmmakers. But yeah, I was trying to think of, the only other stuff I could think of is there are sections of films like New Wave films or like Badlands where time passes, months or years pass, and it's kind of stitched together with memory based, very, very like internal. The way that his narration in this is, well, I'm not really sure if like the point of incarceration is revenge or not. You know, he kind of wonders about
rehabilitation
things.
Versus revenge.
Yeah, like he has just kind of curious ideas, but then he's also telling you what happens, you know.
Yeah. Right before the opening titles hit, he says, you know, in the benefit of hindsight, this might not have been a very good idea. So he's already at the end of the story.
Can you start to pick out for me some of the things that you're seeing that are being set up in the sequence to kind of establish what the pattern that you're looking at?
Well, I mean, I think for one thing is we set up the John Goodman character. We know that he knows them.
Right.
We establish the convenience store as an important place that we're going to go back to, that he's going to be drawn to. One thing that you pointed out is that he works at Hudsucker Industries, which is just a funny little shared universe detail. It says Hudsucker Industries on his jumpsuit. One thing I think we also set up is just that when High's narration comes in, it pushes the story forward. He says, like, I had a dream about the scary guy who attacks everything that's gentle. And then he brings that guy into existence, essentially, through the dream that he has. And then at the end of the movie, he has the dream going through into the future where they have this, like, good, beautiful ending. So the motif of narration, narration-driven montage, sets itself up for other narration-driven montages later in the movie. But more to the point, like, it's just throwing plot at you. 20 minutes of screenplay in 10 minutes. Like, car hits the road, beautiful, beautiful sunrise. There's no way the audience isn't locked in for whatever's about to happen.
You witness these two people go through multiple phases of their lives and their, like, evolution, both alone and as a couple. Like, just even the salad days, that there's, like, a whole happy, where they're just a young couple in love period that, like, begins and ends in the series of a bunch of shots. You just have been through the ups and downs of life with these people. You like them so much. You're so locked in with, like, why it's kind of a miracle that they found each other, which I think is good because the next scene is just getting right into them stealing a child.
Stealing a baby.
Yeah, and I think it's, like, this opening, this, like, rinse and repeat, this cycle that you see them go through, I think it just locks you into them just so tightly so that you're just on board. You understand why they're going to do anything that they do.
It sets up Holly Hunter as, like, this straight-laced character, this cop character who's going to save him.
I was really struck this time by just, like, the repetition, the three looks on his face every time he's getting his photo taken. His relation to his life being so out of control is so visible in the progression and the way that he's describing over the arc of this opening. The big turning point is when he realizes that, like, being in prison actually hurts because there's something that he wants to experience on the outside.
He says, "This is the first time I felt confined."
Yeah. And seeing this woman's life change incrementally in front of him, he starts to realize that he needs to, like, wake up out of this. It's wonderful.
And the deep irony is that she's about to have him commit, like, a way more serious crime than right. he's ever committed before.
But that's what's so great about it is the cutting back and forth between him saying, "You tell him that I think he's a damn fool," you know, just like the him just, like, puffing himself up and strutting around and just being so absurd and cutting back, and she's just it's bringing her to tears, you know, the display of emotion and just how, when he says, "I'll be waiting," the vulnerability in him is just so powerful. He's such a live wire.
And we've been talking about this for like 15 minutes and I want to get on to other, but I just want to say, like, there's so much else in this sequence that we haven't even talked about. There's, like, the therapist, there's the guy talking about the crawdads. Like, multiple times. Like, they have recurring motifs. They have, like, three recurring motifs.
Can I talk about a repetition? Can I just add one on
that
we haven't covered yet?
Yeah.
The "okay then," they say it three times. But instead of it the third time being the parole board saying it,
yeah,
it's the guy that marries. It's the officiator of the wedding.
Yeah, he says, "Okay then."
That's hilarious because it, like, happens faster than you would think it would.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a movie. It's a mini movie inside the movie.
After the second time, you're just primed to hear it again.
From the parole board.
From the parole board. So then when it comes out of the mouth of someone else.
It's a punchline.
Yeah, that's your third one, but it came from an unexpected place. It's really effective. And then everyone stands up and claps, and it's cops on one side and people in, like, bright colors on the other.
Yeah. You see their family and friends for the first time.
Yeah. Well, can I just ask one question?
Yeah.
Can we talk about a grand theory of setups just a little bit? Because, like, is that thing that just happened where it's parole board says it once, parole board says it twice, then it happens a third time, but not in the way you would expect? Is that a setup payoff?
I mean, in a very classical way, for sure. It's like rule of threes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm just interested in that. Can we start to develop? Can you describe a setup in the sequence we just watched and how it works later in the film?
When he goes to the convenience store and takes the gun out and like puts a stocking over his head, the audience is just like, oh shit, I'm about to see something crazy. And in fact, they sure as hell will. I mean, like the fucking chase scene through the grocery store is crazy. And it feels so much more present. There's something about that sequence, the sequence that we're talking about, that does feel in the past, in like it's in the past tense. And then when he actually goes and does the robbery, it's like the most present tense possible scene that kind of just like blows a hole in the middle of the movie.
This is all very montage based. The storytelling is being done in the ellipses. And then after the credit block, it really goes into just like, I'm holding the baby in my hand, but I need to pick up this object, right?
Yeah.
And like, I have the diapers, but I dropped them and now the dog is chasing me. Like, it goes much more into just like objects, like unbroken time, based very moment to moment, almost like a Tom and Jerry cartoon.
With tension building and quiet and
yeah.
who's going to hear me sneaking around? Where is everybody in the house? That type of a pleasure that we didn't necessarily get from that opener.
I square myself with Lazar, if you don't mind. That's why God invented cards. There is one thing he can do for me.
Name it.
Think about what protecting Bernie gets us. Think about what offending Casper loses us.
Oh, come on, Tommy, you know I don't like to think.
Yeah. I'll think about whether you should start.
Next one is their next movie, Miller's Crossing. I just wanted to bring one scene in, this beautiful little two-page scene between Gabriel Byrne and Albert Finney that's right after John Polito storms out. And I kind of wanted to include this as a little mini follow-up because at one point I was like, Miller's Crossing is a movie I struggled with because I felt like Gabriel Byrne's character's like competence wasn't properly... For me, I didn't grab onto the fact that he was someone Albert Finney trusted. But then when I watched it again, I was like, there's this one key little moment right after John Polito storms out where they have a quiet exchange and he says, well, Albert Finney says, you've got gambling debts. I want to take care of them. Matter of fact, I'm not going to let them break your legs. I'm going to call him right now and settle this. Gabriel Byrne hangs up the phone. He says, no, I'll handle it on my own. I'll handle it by gambling and playing cards. So basically, we're setting up the fact that Gabriel Byrne has a gambling problem. It's gotten bad. It's gotten out of control. He won't let his powerful friend help him. It seems like a pretty clear, like, advisor, top guy status relationship. But then Gabriel Byrne stands in the door and says,
think about what protecting Bernie gets us. Think about what offending Casper loses us. Leo says, come on, Tommy, you know I don't like to think. And Tom says, yeah, well, think about whether you should start.
Cut to opening credit sequence with the music. And it's a very similar feeling in terms of like that cut and like feeling like the movie has just like sort of begun. But they did it through a really concise dialogue scene. After the John Polito monologue, which we've discussed. And so I just wanted to contrast those two because we have 20 pages in 10 minutes versus 2-minute scene that establishes this whole character dynamic, which is actually very elegant and beautiful when you watch it. But for me, like a lazy viewer, I almost basically forgot it. And I was like, Gabriel Byrne's a drunk. His life's fucked up. He comes to Marcia Gay Harden's green room and he's trying to get his hat back. And that's how the character is introduced. A, I was wrong about that. But B, like, the interesting thing about this character is, like, while we were watching that opening credit sequence, Gabriel Byrne was getting shit-faced and fucking his life up off camera. And when we see him again, a whole bunch of stuff has gone down.
We come out of the credit sequence with the music and the trees going by to a scene of him waking up, not really knowing where he is or what just happened,
yeah,
and finding out from a friend that basically he got like kicked out or he was blackout at a card game that he lost a lot of money at, basically, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So basically we meet him. Albert Finney is very like brassy. John Polito is, you know, is chewing the scenery off the walls in the beginning. And Gabriel Byrne is this much more introverted kind of on-screen presence. Whereas Holly Hunter and Nicolas Cage, the way that they are and the way that they're being styled is to accentuate their like Tex Avery-ness, right? Like it's being called out. He's got the Roadrunner tattoo.
Yeah, the tattoo, I mean, like another just like amazing detail that just trying to summarize it in longer than the montage is, we still don't have. So they didn't even mention the cartoon.
Yeah, and everything in Miller's Crossing is green or brown or just in the shadows. And Gabriel Byrne just has this much, much lower confident, but like you could miss it. You do miss it. Like I'm just saying this. Whereas
these movies have totally different grammar in terms of what they're setting up. And also ultimately the fact that you could miss it is like his power.
It's like Raising Arizona. They know they have to get you on board, tethered in to watch a film about people that are going to steal a baby and to really be like empathetic towards them for the rest of the movie. And they just make that, they make that deal. They make that handshake in the beginning. Whereas I feel like in Miller's Crossing, they were experimenting with a little bit more of a take it or leave it approach to a protagonist that you don't really understand. This is like a remake of Yojimbo, essentially, right? Or explicitly. It's that story structure where there's two warring parties and there's a character kind of moving in between the two of them in a chaotic pattern. And while they are your protagonist, you don't understand what they were doing. There's a bit of like a sixth sense, like, oh, I understand what their motivation was in retrospect, but that reveal happens in like the last 5 or 10 minutes, which this film definitely falls into. But that's a different experiment than being like, Tom is a mystery, right? You're not watching the film being like, oh my God, I hope Tom's okay. But because you don't feel that way, I just think you stay at a bigger emotional distance from this film.
There's a removal that ultimately makes the movie work beautifully, but it's not like strapping you into a roller coaster.
Yeah. Okay. So because of that nature, that kind of like the twist ending reveals, you know, what was going on all the time. I do think this is a film, the setups are there, but they're kind of like, they're very much not the kind of setups that are giving you information to hold on to in your near memory so that you will then have a big, all the pieces come together in your head and you get that kind of puzzle piecing together satisfaction. Mm-hmm. It's more when you actually start the film again and rewatch it. It's the actual second reading is where the, right? Because you can't actually watch Miller's Crossing at the end be like, oh, that was, I feel like I'm talking this movie down now.
No. You're saying it's a subtle movie. That's really all it is. That's not all it is, but it's a movie that you just have to kind of, it's a movie with more realistic characters, for one thing.
Than Raising Arizona.
I would say. Maybe that's a value judgment on some level. What is the twist?
The twist is more at the end is that Albert Finney in the last scene is like, oh, I didn't realize it. You betrayed me so that you could maneuver on the outside. You know, it's like you knew I wasn't going to trust you. I don't know. I forget exactly what it is. But at the end, the last scene is Albert Finney being like, oh, I get it. You made me think that you were my enemy. But you were protecting me all along. I just wasn't going to trust you because this stuff with Verna made it so that he's not acting rationally. And so Tom's workaround was to do this big, like, double fake out. And so Albert Finney's saying, I'm so glad you did that. Everything's forgiven. Welcome back. At which point Gabriel Byrne says, I'm done, and walks off forever.
And I still feel like I want to rewatch it now and really get that.
Yeah. The big story, the way Albert Finney sees it at the end, is this was ultimately like, he's so good at strategy that this was the only chess move he could do, even though it was very destructive and very hard on him particularly. You know, he took a lot of abuse, which is basically like the way this guy does stuff, is he's got like a brilliant chess mind and he also wants to die. You know, so he'll basically do any chess move that's like incredibly clever to get to the end point and doesn't care how many times he gets beat up along the way. But he really has lost respect for Albert Finney by the end of the film because he doesn't think. Because, I mean, it's what's being set up here with me is you should think about.
I guess you picked that fight with me just to suck yourself in with Casper.
I don't know. You always know why you do things, Lou?
Sure I do. It was a smart play.
Fine.
Gabriel Byrne throughout this movie is treating himself the way that Nicolas Cage is treating himself at the beginning of the movie before he meets Ed.
Yeah.
Like, he's willing to kind of keep getting locked up in prison over and over again.
Like I said, I think he genuinely wants to die. Like, a part of him is just experimenting with getting close to death all the time.
Scary stuff.
Scary stuff, kids. Watch out.
So, next movie I chose was Hudsucker. And, you know, if you want to talk about, like, economy, like, sort of powerhouse, the economy of a powerhouse opener that's, like, completely contained but shows you a ton of stuff. And then, like, the non-powerhouse of, like, just a quiet scene with Albert Finney, Gabriel Byrne, and a telephone to establish so much about how this movie's going to function. Hudsucker is just 40 pages. It's 40 pages until Tim Robbins, Norville Barnes, gets the job as head of Hudsucker. I mean, so the question is like, where is the setup in this movie? So, like, arguably the setup is after Hudsucker kills himself, they're sitting around with the big hole in their window and they say, well, if the stock's cheap, we can all buy it up instead of the public buying it up. The reason I didn't choose that scene is because it doesn't involve the protagonist. But then you kind of just have to choose where you would want, what you would want to analyze for this. I chose the scene in Paul Newman's office, Musburger's office. He's basically trying to figure out, is this guy dumb enough? And then he says, well, no, I made the dean's list. I was voted most likely to succeed. And the guy's like, get out of my office. And then he has to see for himself how dumb he is by trying to put out a fire and then, like, breaking the window and, like, walking around with a fucking bucket on his foot. Like, this is a maximalist movie.
I think it's great. And I'm understanding now that we're in this third selection, what you're doing with this episode in general, which is that, like, what we did in episode one was a lot about tone setting.
Yeah.
Which was the opening monologues. And so these clips now, like, what we talked about before was voiceover and montage, like, establishing a tone, casting a spell, creating a sense of, like, this is the temperature and this is, like, the general, like, salty or sweet flavor of the movie. And now, what's going on? And these are not the opening scenes. These are kind of the scenes that are, like, a scene or two after the opening scene. Once the kind of tone has been established, this is the beginning of putting pieces on the board, right?
Exactly. To me, these are the moments where the movie pivots from intro to plot, to the audience being like, I get it now. And I love Hudsucker. I do think that it's a tough movie. The Norval Barnes becoming the head of Hudsucker Industries happens on page 38, you know? And we still haven't introduced Jennifer Jason Leigh.
We just watched a sequence from 38 minutes into the film.
We watched a scene from, I'm not exactly sure what it is minute-wise, but that scene takes place from page 29 to page 38.
What happened in the first half hour of that movie?
Good question.
Well, the guy kills himself.
The guy kills himself.
Yeah.
They hatch the plan.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, he's getting the job, learning about the mailroom and how the mailroom functions, which is, like, great stuff in terms of, like, Joe versus the Volcano, first act, drudgery, you know, Terry Gilliam, drudgery of the workplace. And there's also the scene where he brings the blue, where there's the scene where he goes up in the elevator and we meet the elevator guy. That's good setup because that character is going to be important. Like, maybe I could have started the sequence in the elevator because that character is going to be, he has his fall from grace in the way he treats that character.
Tim Robbins also arrives in New York City, right?
Yeah. He gets off a bus.
I like the selection that you picked. I liked watching it for sure.
And that's 10 pages too.
Yeah. To me, I was looking at this and I was like, that lobby in Burton Fink, you know, and what it must have been like to build that lobby set on a soundstage and be like, wow, we're really playing with the height of like, because the soundstage is maybe like four stories tall. You really can just be like, suddenly our ceiling, we have a ceiling. We can create a space that's so big. And then this space, this office is just like
10 times as big.
It's just a joke about, like, what is the biggest room that you could possibly, like, build and convey on a soundstage.
This is a movie about a very specific kind of spectacle, and that is definitely set up in these opening scenes. But it's not a plot-heavy movie in the way that, like, Miller's Crossing is.
The guy jumps out the window in the opening. Paul Newman goes out the window. I guess we saw
him at the beginning.
Right. Like, it's really establishing that there's a lot of action going vertically on this building, these characters. I'm interested in what you mentioned before was the way that John Goodman and his partner are introduced in Raising Arizona.
Yeah.
Where they are introduced just as members of a group. They're not specifically called out, but the fact that they're there establishes them as a playing piece. So I'm super curious in this stuff where a piece of setup is laid down, like a piece is put on the board, but at first blush, you're like, well, the purpose of that was one thing, but then...
Like, you don't know when you watch the movie what's being set up and what's not.
Right. And even like the thing that they randomly are saying in the circle is totally, that is the theme that they're going to continue to represent.
They say like a man's work is important.
The counselor says, most men your age high are getting married and raising up a family. They wouldn't accept prison as a substitute. It says here, high looks sheepish, but in the movie, Nicolas Cage says something like, well, actually, and then gets shut down. The counselor says, would any of you men care to comment? Two convicts sitting next to each other, Gail and Evel, appear to be friends. Gail says, but sometimes your career got to come before family. Evel says, work is what's kept us happy.
I feel like I don't have anything to add to that. Like,
well, okay, is there anything that's set up in this, like, Hudsucker scene that, like, is established as, like, as serving one purpose, but is, like, table setting for things that are going to fall later?
One thing I just would say is that the whole thing with the pants.
Yeah.
there's two flashbacks with the ripple warping dream sequence cuts, two of them to Paul Newman's Taylor, Luigi. Like, what is that setting up?
Well, in the context of what we're talking about, it's like a totally gonzo riff on like the anti setup.
It's a non sequitur.
Well,
like for me, like I still don't necessarily know what that means, what they're supposed to say, because it's like Paul Newman, I guess it's basically saying Paul Newman is,
it's like, it's at the moment that he flies out the window, which is so heightened. It's like the boss man chases the papers out the window and is about to die, right? And Tim Robbins catches him.
He's holding him up. He's holding him by his pants.
Okay, so at that moment of like total heightened, exaggerated, you know, like to the nth degree.
High wire act.
Yeah.
And the whole movie is basically holding Tim Robbins over the edge. The whole movie, Tim Robbins is dangling. We don't know what's going to happen.
We now go back in time.
And stop time, the same way that he stopped time.
But like instead of what you've been talking about this entire time, which is like setting something up so that you can pay it off later, we at this moment of just like total unhingedness, we go back in time to set something up in order to just pay it off 15 seconds later. And it's awesome.
It's also just profoundly silly. Luigi the tailor is like, well, Mr. Musburger is such a nice man. I'm going to give him these stitches. That's a good stitch. Here's what I think it represents, if I could be so bold. It's about how people love their work, what they do, in spite of what someone tells them is or is not necessary. He has a passion for that double stitch. Like the double stitch is his hula hoop or his bendy straw. Like he has a passion for this new idea that he wants to share.
He's pitching him the double stitch.
He's pitching the double stitch, and Musburger's like, no, I don't need it. And he's like, well, I'll give it to him anyway. And it's not because he's a nice man. It's because that's a good stitch.
Did you see, not every character with a strong accent is written phonetically on the page. Cy Abelman definitely was, but Luigi for sure. You check it out.
As a summer strong a stitcher, you bet. As the summer strongest teacher.
What the heck? Mr. Musburger, such a nice guy. I give him double teacher anyway.
They're just making sure that it's funny. They're like, they're basically saying, it's important that this guy talks like this because it's funny.
His heart is so pure.
Musburger has pure people in his periphery.
Yeah.
Who are trying to make something good. But capital is getting in the way. I mean, Musburger is the head of a company. He doesn't want to pay for a fucking double stitch. He's pathologically greedy. And that's what it's setting up. That's why that's important. That scene is important.
Yeah.
All right, I'm glad we worked through that. So what's next?
I'm Jerry Lundegaard.
You're Jerry Lundegaard?
Yeah. Shep Proudfoot said...
Shep said you'd be here at 7:30. What gives, man?
Shep said 8:30.
We've been sitting here an hour. He's peed three times already.
Oh, I'm sure sorry. Shep told me 8:30. It was a mix-up, I guess.
You got the car?
Yeah, you bet. It's out in the lot there. Brand new burnt umber Sierra.
Yeah, okay. Well, sit down then.
Fargo.
I'm Carl Showalter.
Wow. This played for me like I had never seen it before. Just when I've watched scenes from Fargo, for this show, and still it's just one of those things where it's like watching a bunch of different scenes all in a row. Suddenly, you just see the way that Fargo stacks up against other pieces of craft, and it just some of the just the very very simple essential things about it just are so striking.
It's tight. We started the movie. We see this is based on a true story. You see a car with a trailer pulling another car, enters the bar. Then
there's an overture. There's a rise. There's a rising action to kind of just punch the opening and just I would say bring you in, set the tone perfectly. Some of the best opening wordless sequences ever.
Other than the Miller's Crossing scene, this is the shortest. I think this is the shortest scene I picked. And there's so much in there that's going to pay off. If Raising Arizona is the maximalist setting off a rocket, this is more just how much can you accomplish in such a short amount of time? How much character, how much plot, how much atmosphere and tone can you pack into one scene that kind of puts the key in the ignition?
Absolutely. I think it's a great lens to look at it through. They're basically just laying out, this is the dynamic. This is the dynamic that is going to be the motor that's going to run this crime story. Everything that's going to follow is because of what they're laying down here. And that's just going to keep making patterns throughout the rest of the film. But the big things that stand out, first off, the two criminals are almost trying to convince him
not to do it.
They're basically trying to talk him out of it, which because I saw this film when I was so young and I'm so used to all the stuff that happens in the second and third act with these guys, and it's so bloodthirsty. It was really striking to me that the dynamic in this opening scene is really them being like, you were supposed to be here an hour ago. This doesn't really make sense. They're on the fence. They're not sold yet.
And it's not just that they think they're being set up
or
they're being screwed. They're literally like, this guy's not a criminal.
Yeah.
But he's trying to do something really fucked up.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know what he's in for. And this is going to be a whole bunch of fucking work for us.
Yeah.
And I think these guys kind of know in the back of their minds. Like Steve Buscemi says, you're tasking us with this mission, but you won't tell us. And then the Peter Stormare character gives him a little look. And then he says, what the hell? Let's look at that Sierra. And they have a beautiful fade out. But on some level, they know this is going to be harder than the guys making it seem.
Right. Because the problem is that Jerry is the kind of guy, and what they get to really quickly is that he's the kind of guy who would rather set this whole thing in motion, draw these kinds of people into his family's life than to ask his wife and his father-in-law a direct question. Either he doesn't trust them or he's right that the answer is going to be no, that they would just let him plummet. So he has that barrier set up with the people in his personal life, and then with these criminals that he's bringing in to help him deal with that situation, he also won't let them in. And that's what Carl is complaining about at the end, is he's like, you're asking us to go into crime with you, but you won't let us know what's going on. And you're asking us to go into crime with you so that you won't have to tell your own family what's going on, but you don't even want to let us. And he's just like, all right, man.
He chalks it up to personal matters,
yeah,
which is just so great. There's so many ins and outs of the way this scene ping-pongs between the different characters. And when Peter Stormare, who's a man of few words, decides to say something. Or your fucking wife.
Or your fucking wife, Jerry.
Do you remember in the 90s when I'm not going to debate you, Jerry, was kind of a catchphrase that people would say?
Of course.
I'm not going to debate you, Jerry.
Of course. I mean, in my mind, so there's that, and there's that on top of that.
They don't know I need it, see? Okay, so there's that. And even if they did, I wouldn't get it. So there's that on top then.
And the other thing that this movie is setting up too is just the folksy, aw shucks charm of some of these Minnesota characters versus the hard-nosed, incredibly to-the-point characters.
Well, Stormare is basically he's in rigor mortis. in this scene.
He's passed out.
I guess he's drank. It's also really funny that it's like a movie logic thing of like, every time you drink a beer, the beer just stays on your table rather than someone would come around and like, the fact that they have like all 10 beers that they drank in 1 hour in front of them.
Shows the passage of time.
It shows the passage of time. Can I talk about some stuff that I noticed too, just in terms of like the way that lighting can kind of like design what a shot, like what you're looking at in a shot. I feel like the way the light hits the top of William H. Macy's hair and really, really just like fully draws your eye to that exact haircut he has and the way it makes that kind of like flat pompadour, blonde flat pompadour. If you just look at these frames, it really, really like almost like with a marker, it just like etches out like, hey, look at this haircut and just exactly kind of how artificial and how like it's a wall. It's a fortress haircut. And then in the reverse, the way similarly the light falls off and creates a shape of just Buscemi's eyes are sunken for sure. But they really just, it's like he's drawing with marker, with shadow. Just like it's sunken eyes, like hollow cheekbones versus this just like suburban, like almost like his hair is like a car. I definitely talked about this in True Grit also, like how a backlight on hair, it's almost like costuming that you can give a character to kind of change. Yeah, I've been like looking at different interviews with Mary Zoffers, and she just keeps coming back to a thing of, okay, well, these pants really change the shape of Oscar Isaac's like whole silhouette. Costume design, not so much in terms of just like texture or the story that it tells. Marge's jacket completely changes the silhouette of Fran McDormand from what she would appear to be in another movie. And like Sugar, just how starchy his jacket is, completely changes his silhouette. And if you look at the characters side by side in silhouette, you can kind of like see the dynamics of the story.
Hey, any boys, Smithies? Or, if not Smithies per se, were you otherwise trained in the metallurgic arts before straightened circumstances forced you into a life aimless wandering?
The trio, George Clooney, Tim Blake Nelson, John Turturro, they're running up to a train. They're about to jump on the train.
Yeah.
What happens in movies when people are running after a train? They fucking jump on, right? And then we have a scene on a train. This movie, they jump on. George Clooney's like, any of you guys metallurgists? Hey, were any of you guys metallurgists before you became hobos? And then Tim Blake Nelson is trying to jump on. George Clooney's not extending a hand to his compatriot. And falls, and they fly off the train. And the movie goes in a different direction. They don't get on the train, and they start talking about the treasure. I wanted to include this scene because it feels like a similar zag to Paul Newman falling out the window and getting caught, and just cutting to doing the whole Taylor thing. It's like, can you think about how much work it would take to have an actual train? Because there's no CG. This movie is very like color graded, but they definitely had a real train going in 1999 with three actors or stunt performers running after it and like doing a lot of that stuff for a scene that could get cut out. You could just cut that scene out, just kind of like the Taylor thing. You could cut Luigi the Taylor out, but there's something important for them that George Clooney doesn't help Tim Blake Nelson up, that he's a selfish person. Or there's something about the seeing a guy jump on and then get dragged off that was important to them for the setup of the movie.
Well, first off, it's so burned in my memory because it was in the initial trailer. So the second it starts, like, you remember this plays out kind of in real time in like the first trailer that was released for the film?
I don't remember that.
Yeah, this whole thing, like, that's the way the trailer starts, is them running after the thing. He does the whole spiel and gets pulled out. It's just emblazoned on my brain. It also makes me think of seeing this film for the first time in the theater in the Lincoln Center multiplex in the second room, not in the big room, but in the second biggest room, which is a thing that I've always wanted to talk to you about on this podcast, is that theater, not the IMAX theater. Do we know the name of this room?
Do you know the name?
I just call it Room 2.
It has a name. I mean, I think all the rooms in that theater, I mean, that was that movie. When I think of when someone says the word irrational exuberance, of the 19, like when they're referring to like the 1990s economy, I think about that escalator and the fucking paintings on the wall and like the way it's trying to recapture the like movie palace feeling, but it's so late 90s in the way that they designed it and the gigantic IMAX screen. And I love that movie theater, but it's like no one will ever make a movie theater like that ever again.
So that's what I'm saying. When I watch this scene, I remember watching the scene on my iMac on QuickTime over and over again and then going and seeing it in room 2 at Lincoln Center. So it brings me very, very strongly back to that. But then on top of that.
Wait, can I, but on the subject of the movie theater, can I just say that real quick, just as a little sidebar, I like the remake of West Side Story, but I don't really understand how much they changed versus how much they didn't. And my big pitch is if I could go to Spielberg and Tony Kushner and try to help them save this fucking thing, I would be like, make it gangs in the mid-90s.
Yes.
Mid-90s period piece gangs.
Yeah.
And instead of destroying the neighborhood to do the Lincoln Center, they're building the movie theater.
Right.
They're building the Lincoln Square 13.
Right. So we That's can go see Titanic.
Exactly. So we can go and see Pleasantville. Titanic.
Yeah.
What was the first movie you saw in that movie theater?
I'm not sure what the exact first one was, but I know that seeing Pleasantville there after getting dinner across the street at Ollie's, the noodle place, the Chinese food noodle place, that was like the first like total lock where it was like seeing Pleasantville in room 2. I think I had just started going to LaGuardia.
Oh, because they have a mezzanine for theater 2.
Right.
And I remember someone being like, that movie theater is crazy because every movie is in an IMAX screen.
Mm-hmm.
What they really meant was, I saw a movie not in IMAX and it was in a giant screen with a mezzanine.
Yeah.
I'll tell you two movies I saw in that theater.
Yeah.
In that room. Something to Talk About. Which I think I was sitting in the mezzanine for.
Right.
And Heat.
Amazing.
Amazing. Heat was amazing.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen it again since I saw it in theaters.
Here's my argument for, this is really off track, but here's my argument for Room 2 at Lincoln Center. You're going to see a movie there that's not, it's not the level of like a blockbuster IMAX type 4-quadrant movie. That's not what's playing. But if you can pack that room, it's a density of a crowd that really does make it feel like it could turn into a riot. It's got that like real, like we're all about to go over a cliff together kind of feeling of watching a film on like a big, big screen. But it's something that's more, it's usually a little more interesting and nuanced than what you're watching in the IMAX theater. You ever see that movie, The Defiant Ones? But the two guys that escape from prison and they're chained together?
No.
Okay, well, this is like Defiant Ones plus another. So I think like the game is like it's three guys tied together and this whole scene is leading up to like what is the funniest delivery of like things that would happen if three people are tied together. And it's basically like
the Defiant Threes.
It's the Defiant Threes and like someone in the deep background of a shot, like through a frame in the frame, does a pratfall. It leads to that. The causality is a second guy does a pratfall. And that causes like the guy who's the most aloof of anyone who's ignoring the other two to do a pratfall and get like dragged across the floor. They love to do the like floor drag. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like Fran McDormand's toe across the floor in Blood Simple. It's like Nicolas Cage being pulled and his like nails on the floor. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're on the ground and you're being dragged. Yeah.
Or even just you're even Frances McDormand's scarf getting pulled into the machine.
Yeah. Well, it's just like the ultimate payoff is just the look on George Clooney's face as he's being pulled with his chin on the ground, like backwards. That's good stuff.
And what is that setting up?
What is that setting up?
Yeah, in your opinion.
I don't know what's setting up later in the film, but I understand the way that it works in the pattern of 1, 2, 3. Defiant Ones is a whole film based around the dynamic of like, how do you escape when everything you do is directly linked to another person, right?
Yeah.
But this is like three guys. The dynamic that they're setting up is like one of them thinks he's incredibly superior to the other two. I vote for yours truly. I vote for yours truly. I'm with both you guys.
That's the dynamic between the three characters.
Right. Exactly. And it's like even their haircuts are like a spectrum of like George Clooney's got this big like it's unkempt and it's like overgrown even though it's like high concept. And then Turturro's just got this like it's just his skull. Tim Blake Nelson has kind of like George Clooney's haircut from the top and then
Do you know what I mean? He's got like half pompadour. He's just got the like the worst balance of
both haircuts.
If you
think he's with both, when he says I'm with you guys, you think the hair is saying that as well?
I honestly think it tracks.
One of our goals for this podcast is to be in the top five hair film podcasts. Number one, obviously, is Lex G. We could try to be in the top five. Should we do Hair Corner?
Yeah.
Okay. Just setting it up. We could do Hair Corner.
Okay. So the dialogue between the three haircuts in this movie.
And then we have the seer literally saying, I can see the future. Here's what's going to happen.
Can I just circle back just for one second? So you think the fact that this is presented as like a potential road, like isn't this just an example of how they're going to fail? Like in a normal story, you would hop a freight train at the beginning and that would be the beginning of the adventure, right? Mm-hmm. But in this situation, because it's three guys tied together and because they're so... like they're not in unity, you know, they're at odds with each other and they're not coordinating. They can't even stay on the train, right?
It's also just filler because they're about to meet like a wise seer who's going to impart this mystical information.
Yeah.
It's like breaking off of a chain gang and they steal a chicken and we have the opening credit sequence. And then there just needs to be some business that happens before they meet the guy. But like, it's also a misdirect. It's a zag.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that, and then there's that on top of that.
That I was just saying, that phrasing has rung in my head for like 20 years, yeah.
Well, I guess it's just like one thing. I guess I just want to note the fact that the blind seer character telling them what's going to happen is like literally the most old school version of setup you could possibly have in a story. Like it goes back to, you know, Greek and antiquity and beyond. It's one of the oldest versions of setup possible. Is a character who says, I can see the future and here's what it is. But also having it be cryptic and something that you don't totally know how it's all going to come together.
Like, you know how those Mission Impossible movies start with scenes from later in the film, right? And it's like, how does this not ruin the enjoyment of the movie?
Yeah.
It's like, I guess maybe the answer is it's only a piece. It's like a shard and like everything that's going to get you like to the point where you're seeing a cow on a cotton house.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have no idea by the time you're seeing that all this other stuff has happened. And it's almost like as a byproduct of the flood. Right. Then all of a sudden you're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
There's the cow on the cotton house.
Right. And then that's like the question is like if setup is both priming the audience that something's going to happen, it also has to withhold as much or more in order to maintain that, you know, dramatic tension that's going to see you through the movie.
Yeah.
I wanted to get that little bit in there.
Yeah, I think it's great.
Okay, so Lady Killers, 2004. I chose the scene where Tom Hanks knocks on Irma P. Hall's door, Marva Munson, also the name of a judge in Intolerable Cruelty, same name. Immediately, her cat runs out, and he has to rescue the cat from the tree. Very similar to Llewyn Davis, in fact.
Yeah.
He climbs up the tree, falls off, the branch breaks, trying to get the cat, and he wakes up passed out, and she's giving him some tea. And then he asks her if there's a room to let. He says, aren't you interested why I darkened your door? She says, well, I was interested until you let the cat out. Again, I chose this because it's a zigzag. It feels very much like Paul Newman hanging out the window and then having the vision of Luigi or guys getting on the train and then getting pulled off.
Okay, so can you use Fargo as kind of like a comparison?
Yeah.
And can you write me a version of the opening of Fargo that is as digressive as the opening of Oh Brother or Lady Killers?
I can tell you that in the script for Fargo, there's another extra little scene where William H. Macy checks into a hotel. He turns on the TV. He watches TV. Then he sits in the Red Lobster, and the waitress with a pot of coffee comes up to him, says, can I warm that up for you there? And he says, you bet. The man looks at his watch. Cut scene from Fargo. Moment of stasis or hesitation before we get into the plot. And in that movie, they cut it right out. They go right into it.
Yeah.
Didn't need it.
So they're in different modes.
Yeah.
And then different films.
Yeah.
What do you think the purpose is of the different modes?
What do I think the purpose?
Why does he go into the tree? Can I say what I think it establishes?
Yeah, tell me.
Okay. It's that he so doesn't want the police to show up To me, that's what it underlines.
It shows that he's a criminal, basically.
Whatever he's got going on in this interaction, as much as he's so worried about how he appears, and he definitely is not going to be able to climb this tree, it's so worth it for her not to call the cops so that he can keep having this conversation. And he doesn't mind that he gets concussion in the middle of it. It's still a great day for him.
He's in trouble. He doesn't want to interface with law enforcement.
Definitely not. Number one priority, avoiding that.
It's good setup for sure. But when the door knocked, the like candle dimmed. So in terms of table setting and tone, like we know this guy is a bad guy.
We know he's a bad guy. The fact that he's willing to get in the tree and fall out of it to avoid the police is like, I think the only indication for sure that he is a criminal, right? Unless I'm forgetting some stuff that happens earlier in the film.
No.
That tips you off. But like, no.
First time we see him is when he knocks on the door.
Yeah. It's unspoken, but that's what I think the whole tree thing does, is it's a way of letting you know that what you're watching is he's down in the basement doing, he's in some way he's going to steal something.
And he goes upstairs. Then he says, oh, you wouldn't happen to have a root cellar, would you? So that really what he wanted to do was he did want to rent a room. And then he says, do you have a root cellar for me and my ensemble to practice in? And then they go down there and he puts his cane in like the soft clay.
Right.
And he says, this is marvelous. This is perfect for the acoustics. But really, it's a setup.
The sounds that he makes, to me, that's like Castaway level Tom Hanks. Just like, you know, he comes across as so just kind of like he's on kind of neutral porridge setting a lot of the time. But just when asked, when something's like, what is the line? What does it say in the script? Like, what do they throw him?
Oh, what does he say? How do they write out?
Yeah, like, what's the noise?
A little dank, ain't it?
Indeed. That only improves the acoustics.
Because I feel like he just takes it so far.
Hurry! Hurry! Hurry!
I'm going to cut the noise into the podcast.
Oh, that's great. Little dank, ain't it? Oh, indeed, but that only improves the acoustics. He experimentally claps his hands. Okay, so I guess Hanks plus that, it was a hand clap in the script. Those dolphin noises that he's making.
That is why so much music of the Cinquecento is played in crypts and catacombs. This is ideal.
He plussed it.
That's pure Hanks. That's a good callback to when we talked about, have there been times when they've let their actors off the leash?
Yeah. It often seems like that is what is added, is like a bit of physical business that really, like, I was going to say earlier, like I was following Tim Robbins when he's holding the drawing of the hula hoop, you know, and then he looks at it and turns it upside around. Down. It's not in the script.
That's not in the script?
Not in the script. But
that's, I mean, if Robbins came up with that, that is so fucking funny. Like, because that's such a good little detail.
It seems like if I was recommending to anyone at this point in our process of understanding this, if you're going to act in a Coen Brothers film, this seems like this is the doorway. This is the avenue where you can get your material into the movie. It's not changing the dialogue, but like
something funny with a prop or a vocalization.
Add a physical joke, and it seems like they will mostly be like, yeah, 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 bring it on board.
It's like Walt Disney, like paid by the gag.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you get Snow White, where it's just like 16 cuckoo clocks, and each one works in a different way. Just the way Hanks holds the frame together with that fucking costume is like, and that hat.
He's built like a temple or like a wedding cake, you know? It's so funny, though, to watch that now that we have the Elvis performance.
He finally got to where he wanted to go with, I think, when he looked at Lady Killers and he was like, I can take this someplace that I think is, like, really wild. And for, like, a whole host of reasons, people were like, that's not what I was expecting or wanted. And then with Elvis, they just figured out a way to craft a movie around, like, another amazing performance where he's the showman.
I don't know if we've talked about this on air yet, as much as this show kind of like assumes that a lot of our audience is Coen Brothers completists. I do have like one big hole in my, I'm not a completist yet, and that I've never been able to watch Lady Killers all the way through. I've tried. I really have tried. I've always been ejected, but.
Well, so hold that thought.
I am coming to this having watched a lot more of that Elvis movie than I have of Lady Killers. So now when I watch this, I'm just like, oh, Hanks looks so hot. He looks like incredible. He looks so healthy. And yeah, I mean, it's like, he looks great.
He looks and sounds great.
Yeah.
Ozzy, come on. Look, we're not terminating you.
This is an assault. I have a drinking problem? Fuck you, Peck. You're a Mormon.
Ozzy.
Next to you, we all have a drinking problem. What the fuck is this? Whose ass didn't I kiss? Huh? Let's be honest.
Okay.
I mean, let us be fucking honest. This is a crucifixion. This is political. And don't tell me it's not. I have a drinking problem.
Burn after reading. We start off with Malkovich walking down the hall, enters, and every millisecond of that performance, of everyone's performance in that room, ping-ponging off each other, the guy behind him.
It's Olsen and Peck. Olsen is the guy in the background. Peck is the Mormon.
Yeah. He says, we're not firing you. We're taking you off of this. He just immediately says, this is a crucifixion. And don't say it's not. This is political. He just quits. I mean, the scene is so short, too. Like, if I had just picked this scene as the setup, which I could have done, this scene might be shorter than... This might be shorter than every scene except for the Miller's Crossing scene. It's so... And they don't have any jokes are packed into this scene. Like if the Fargo scene is all, like, character dynamics and little details, this is, like, joke after joke. It's, like, physical comedy. It's, like, next to you, we're all alcoholics. Everybody is just on full cylinder. And even just when Malkovich leaves the room and the guy just looks, like, just but the way that the guy looks and there's, like, a little vibration in the shot is just so fucking funny. He's like, I have a drinking problem. And then we cut to him crunching the ice from the ice maker. It's like, it's way better than if you just cut to him pouring himself a drink. It's just the way he's like crunching the ice. And then we have the dinner party scene. And I wanted to include this because there's so much setup packed into this. And like, if you were like teaching a screenwriting class and you were like, how can I do exposition elegantly? Not by characters just saying stuff, but like by like pinging off each other. John Malkovich being like, maybe he'll show you his big gun. And the way he says gun is so funny. And the way his face says gun is so funny. And then George Clooney being like, it's no big deal. 20 years of service, never discharged my weapon. They ask, what does your wife do? And Clooney totally talks over his wife and just says, children's books, just children's books. They're great. The setup is coming so fast that like characters are talking over each other. Setting up his character is just like a completely fucking thoughtless bore. Then Tilda Swinton says, why don't you let your wife explain herself instead of you talking over her and join me in the kitchen? We see them in the kitchen and he says he knows about us. And then he talks about the floor.
Forbo. It's a flooring system.
And then the last scene that I had to just keep going, maybe just because I just had to include it because I just fucking love this movie so much. But just the forward momentum energy goes straight into, they cut into the scene. There's another great like things that people say about a scene is like, get into the scene late. We cut and she says, you got fired. And he says, I didn't get fired. I quit. And there's an amazing shot of her, two Tilda Swintons, Tilda Swinton, two mirrors. And she says, how are you going to live? And he says, I'm thinking about writing a sort of memoir. And I cannot do it. But you know that they did like 10 takes where they were like, can you keep saying it funnier? Can you keep adding that the actor accent onto it?
I've been thinking about writing a book or, you know, a sort of memoir.
And then she laughs. It's just every line in this movie is funny. Every line in this movie hits.
Yeah, I think it's stunning. It really just comes down to he just can't hear anything about himself, right? Like, that's the big problem. Like, they're just offering him a, like, it's not going well. His wife, like, finds the idea of him writing a memoir, like, totally laughable. He is drinking too much and he just won't take any of it, right?
He storms out. He quit rather than hearing that.
Right. That's the character, right? That's just what's going to continue. He's just going to keep just like throwing that kind of a tantrum for the rest of the movie, right?
Yes.
And those tantrums are, that's what's going to set. Like in the same way that like what they're discussing in the opening of Fargo is like, this is the pattern. This is like the motor that's going to set the rest of this crime story into motion. He's the event. Like he's what's broken about his heart and his soul is what's going to set all of this other stuff into motion.
And ultimately he's going to be the character who does something that's so egregious that the people who are surveilling them feel they have to step in. They're going to break the fourth wall.
Yeah. Which is ultimate, I guess at the beginning, it's about them shutting him down also.
Right.
So it's like they try to shut him down. He throws a tantrum because he doesn't want to take it. And then all these other people get kind of, who are also very vulnerable and have these huge desires that they can't like reckon with, get kind of sucked into this tornado. And then all just kind of gets like folded up.
Those CIA guys, J.K. Simmons and David Rash, when we cut to them, David Rash is set up early in this movie as a person in an advisory role who is basically in charge of, if not hiring and firing, then delivering the news. Later, when they come back, the people behind the curtain in this paranoid thriller have had to step in. So the next time we see David Rash, George Clooney just shot Brad Pitt with his gun, you know, with his Chekhov's gun. David Rash is talking to J.K. Simmons being like, our guy saw him drop the guy into the bay, and we fished him out. He says, "The body, what are you doing? Get rid of it." But like the way that these characters function is to basically pay off in a sense.
Yeah.
Like these characters are they're like the wrapping paper around the movie that kind of keeps it all in check.
Yeah.
Which is why when I first saw the movie and it ended on those characters and we didn't actually get to see like what happened, I was like, you know, what an anticlimax. And then the more you see the movie, you're like, that's what this whole fucking movie is about.
I think it's wonderful. Something is jumping out to me in terms of like all of these scenes being about like, once you've established kind of like a tone and a tempo for a film, you're starting to put your first pieces on the board. You know, here's the first round of pieces of information that you need, and then we're going to deliver round after round of information as the story goes on. But that, like, most of these segments are people meeting each other, and this one is different. All the relationships are pre-established. It's about the dissolving of relationship. Mm. The only other one that's like that is Miller's Crossing. Tim Robbins is meeting Paul Newman. Steve Buscemi and Stormare are meeting William H. Macy. Tom Hanks is meeting Irma P. Hall. It's about Nick Cage and Holly Hunter meeting.
Getting together.
You know what I mean?
There's ongoing shit between them. Like, he knows, damn it. No, he doesn't know anything. Things have not been going well.
Yeah, but I think it is interesting. Like, I think one is, like, a lot brighter and poppier. Like, making a story where people are just kind of starting the story by saying, like, hi, this is who I am. How are you doing? Like, what's our first getting to know each other interactions is like, yeah, it's very transparent way if you're a third party of observing the story kind of getting set up.
Yeah. And maybe that's a reason that this movie, despite the fact that I think it plays so well, maybe that's a reason why some people bounced off of it.
You're describing like Burn After Reading being one that's like a little bit like, huh, like what was that experience? But then watching it again, knowing the structure, I feel like it's very similar to the way we're talking about Miller's Crossing.
Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I think it's hard to, like, going back in time and remembering that Burn After Reading is a movie that many people consider to be a total fucking misfire from the Coens.
Yeah.
Like, of a piece with Lady Killers and Intolerable Cruelty, you know? Especially after No Country. I think part of it is the context of No Country for Old Men being a huge Oscar movie nominated at the wazoo.
Hardware. Taking home Hardware.
They took home Hardware. And then 2008... they do a deep state paranoid thriller. First year of the Obama administration.
I saw this film in upstate New York, and it was the weekend that Julianne Moore played Sarah Palin for the first time on Saturday Night Live. It came out when it was the number one cultural thing going on was the election.
So it's like Arrival, where it like came out right before people knew who was going to be president.
Yeah.
It was made by people who didn't know who was going to be president.
For sure. And we were all spending, like, you and I were both spending a lot of time on the Taking Woodstock set. I literally went, like, I spent the day acting in Taking Woodstock, and then that night went and saw Burn After Reading in like a upstate New York, like small suburban multiplex.
How did you react to it?
I think my reaction to it was often my reaction to their films the first time I watch it, which was that I'm often just a little shocked by how badly things turn out for the characters. Didn't go into it with a lot of expectation of like, oh, it's going to be this way, it's going to be that way. I think it was pretty open. But I think they really do have a tragic outlook, even when they're being funny, that I think is always, yeah, it's quite an intense shock for me the first time I see it. I think that's like mainly what I took away from it. But Brad Pitt and like Richard Jenkins and stuff, I do remember liking that a lot. Your shit. Like, I remember thinking that was funny.
When is it? Oh, about the security of your shit.
Yeah, like that's really, I feel like on a first viewing, that stuff popped really hard for sure. And also, you are a moron. You're, what's the line?
You're in a league of morons.
The league of morons. I think that like that jumped out to me, and that has been like ringing in my head. Like that's a pretty like a pretty constant frame through which I see things.
The culture was ready for something kind of bright and uplifting about like kind of getting out of that administration. And these guys were like, the deep state fucking sucks. DC, the people who live there and the people who run this thing are the most insane detached bureaucrats you've ever met. And I don't think people wanted to hear that. And like, if this movie had come out in 2013, like with the Snowden stuff, I mean, it's basically a Snowden movie before. Like, there's an argument to be made that like Edward Snowden saw this movie in Hawaii in 2008 and was like, I think I'm going to start copying some of these things onto a disc. If we ever get in touch with Snowden, could ask him what he thought about Burn After Reading.
I think the thing that was the big new information for me when I saw this film was just the kind of like what it felt like to hang out in the affluent suburbs of Washington, D.C., where all these people that you see on cable news or, you know, that you read in the paper, lobbyists and stuff like that. This is the actual like the village that they all live in, where they're all each other's neighbors, and just kind of how cozy, but how kind of high stakes, like how you could lose it all. And that those people then go from this kind of suburban village to these fluorescent office buildings where all this kind of crazy power is operating.
This is a part of the world where a lot of people are wearing suits.
Yeah.
And a lot of them could have concealed guns.
Yeah. George Clooney's energy in this film is so strange. This versus what's coming next with the Hail Caesar performance.
Yeah.
He's so spiky.
Yeah.
He's so just kind of like, he's chomping that goat cheese so hard.
The fact that he says he could go into anaphylactic shock and that doesn't happen, but he also says he has a big gun and that does happen. Like, that's a great example, I think, of like this movie could have gone in three different ways. And as a viewer, you're picking up those breadcrumbs and being like, is this setting something up?
The dynamic is he's so spiky and weird and kind of all over the place that the second she's like, do this, you know, he's just happy to follow along.
He's got a thing for domineering ladies.
I think so, yeah.
And cheating on them.
Yeah. Hail Caesar.
Hail Caesar, last one. I wanted to go with the scene where Eddie Mannix is talking to his assistant. They're talking about, and Gloria de Lamar has checked into Our Lady of Perpetual Rest to dry out.
You have a 10 a.m. with Monsignor O'Reilly at the Wallace Beery Conference Room, and he's bringing a Leicester Silkwood from the Legion of Catholic Decency. And we've also invited Patriarch Vlassos for their Eastern view.
Have they read the script?
Roger.
Let's also invite a rabbi and a Protestant padre of some sort so we can get everybody's 2 cents.
Check.
How's production on Tucum Carey?
Principal is on schedule, but second unit has been idle in Gallup, New Mexico for 4 days. Heavy rain.
Forecast?
Not good.
Send an insert truck. Have them shoot driving place for came the rain.
Check.
They're rained out in Mexico. The interesting thing about this is that they're talking about things that you're going to see later in the movie. They're also talking about movies that have absolutely nothing to do with the plot of this movie. They're setting up the idea that, like, actors are constantly kind of like going on benders and not showing up to set. And they say, they talk about how Scarlett Johansson's character has a problem. He says, I know what it is. I'll go talk to her. He goes into the office, gets on the phone with Skank. This is the character's name.
Shank. S-C-H-E-N-K.
Skank. They call him Skank.
Can you also? Yes. Good morning, Mr. Skank. Very well. Thank you.
Audio clip. We just listened to the audio clip.
Mr. Skank.
Skank basically inaudibly says you have to put Hobie Doyle in this movie because you need a male lead in Merrily We Dance. He's basically saying the kid's not very good at talking. He's like a dust actor. But then he's like, no, no, okay, it could work. Basically, we're setting up the idea that this guy on the phone in New York, whatever he says goes, no matter how insane it is. Part of Eddie Mannix's job is making this guy's suggestion be implemented. Then we do Hobie Doyle, stunt, 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 stunt. Hobie Doyle stunting on horses. Alden Ehrenreich killing it. It's so like action for its own sake. It's a similar zag. This movie is like all set piece, you know? Like on top of the story, this movie just has the most extended dance scene possible with the sailors. It has the Busby Berkeley sequence. There's the whole drawing room scene. So like this is a movie that like, it's a movie with movies within movies.
Well, I think the point of having these exuberant Western stunt action sequence in here that's just so beautiful is, isn't ultimately Eddie Mannix is like the defender of show business. When the guy tries to seduce him to working on the atom bomb instead, he's like, the atom bomb is something real, whereas what you're doing really doesn't matter. And I think ultimately the movie has to make a case for like what is great about exactly what you can tell the stuff they're making is not being made with integrity. The end result of it is kind of cathartic. It's not great art, but you need to taste it as you're watching the film.
Yeah. But wouldn't it be great if Hobie Doyle did some rope tricks to like solve the case? I'm not actually making that argument, but I'm saying like, if you saw this character setting all this stuff up in the scene, wouldn't you expect that that character would like lasso a motherfucker at some point in the movie later?
In a different film, maybe. I mean, I guess my question is like, do you remember what is the big turn at the end of what's Mannix's big, like what's his arc in like the third act?
Mannix is being tempted to leave this business.
Right.
And basically, his catharsis is George Clooney comes in with his head full of communist ideas and says, like, this whole system, these workers are just doing whatever this guy Skank says. And what we're making is bread and circuses. And Mannix slaps him around a few times the same way that he hit the girl for doing pinup photos, which I didn't include, but it is important setup. He slaps Clooney around and says, don't you ever talk about Skank this way. He pays everybody's bills. And like, more importantly, like you're going to go out there and do this speech because it has worth and the words have worth and you have worth and everyone working on these movies has worth and it has value in and of itself. So go out there and be a star.
Okay. So I think that's why this Western scene is in there, is because it's important in this film that they occasionally just give you first person experiences of watching these movies, of like how rad it looks, that shot leading him, the horse is coming straight towards the camera and the ground is just peeling out below. It's like, it's really exhilarating. It's not fake exhilarating. It has worth within itself, even if the way that it's made is like patently absurd.
And they're like doing the whole thing with the swivel around, with the stunt, like the way that he's like swinging around on a like a chin-up bar is hokey. Like they make choices to make those stunts be hokey in a way that the movies that they love are hokey, and that which makes them all the more movies that they love.
But you can also see a version of that where it's very clear that it's a green screen or rear projection. What you're seeing there is like, that is really a camera moving across a real landscape. There's BTS stuff that I've already put on social media showing him do those flipping tricks. Like a lot of that he's doing unassisted. Yeah, there's real spectacle to it. I mean, I guess they're making this after they've done a lot of horse stuff.
They're not only making a Western, they're making a very specific type of like early 50s Western. Another movie within the movie is Lazy Old Moon, a singing cowboy musical Western, which, by the way, I got to put this on record because I've never heard anybody say it before, which is that movie is Moonstruck. That's a 50s Western version of the movie Moonstruck.
Okay, build it out.
They worked with Nicolas Cage in that time period, but like they're saying something about the movie Moonstruck. In Hail Caesar, with the way that the characters are like crazed by the giant moon. It's like such a specific motif. I don't know what they're saying, but that's the reference.
I love it. Do you think it needs to be, you want to build that out more, or do you feel like you've...
I don't think I have much more to say. I just want to say that Lazy Old Moon is a reference to Moonstruck. And that's interesting because that's a movie that came out when they were getting their careers started in the 80s.
Yeah.
and that Nicolas Cage made like a career-defining performance in.
Yeah.
In the same time period as Raising Arizona.
Yeah. So in their experience of 80s Hollywood, Moonstruck was kind of akin to the film Lazy.
Or Hobie Doyle is Nicolas kind Cage. Of akin to Nicolas Cage.
Yeah, right. Because isn't that, I have that clip where they were worried that he was too urban to play high.
I did not know that.
Yeah, that was their big concern, is that they're like, he's such an LA guy.
He showed him.
Yeah, but you could see that, be like, oh, he's like, he's from these Coppola movies and he's so kind of slick and rock and roll.
The interesting thing about this movie is that it's unlike a movie where a lot of bad, you were saying like you when you watched Burn After Reading, you were just kind of like a little bit in shock about how badly, like what bad things the characters got themselves into. And like, nobody really goes, nothing bad really happens to any of the characters. And in fact, Eddie Mannix makes the decision to stay in the same job that he had. And he just decides, he basically decides that he loves this and he wants to keep doing it because the work that he's doing is hard but rewarding. And that's the most important thing. The priest tells him that God wants us to do the work that is right, that feels right in your heart.
Is this their most gentle movie?
Is this their most gentle movie? No, I mean, it's too rambunctious to be called gentle.
But what's, think about it. What's like...
Okay, does anyone get...
I'm saying lightest, you know? Even Big Lebowski, which is like a very bright film. Dark stuff, dismemberment.
Donnie gets killed. Crime. Donnie dies of a heart attack.
Seriously.
Somebody gets their ear bitten off.
Right. So that's not like, I'd say Hail Caesar's is more gentle and lighter. Like, what?
It's gentler on the characters.
Just look at the list.
Yeah.
Most of these films are about kidnapping.
Well, this movie's about kidnapping.
But I'm saying, like how many of these films are just, like, the plot? It's, like, kidnapping, 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 kidnapping.
Oh, Brother doesn't have... I mean, the characters get knocked around a lot, though. Characters get the shit beaten out of them. Hail Caesar has, like, the atom bomb... It opens on Josh Brolin slapping around an actress.
There's different parts of their personality, right? There's an aspect of them that's like Llewyn Davis. Where it's like, I got my poetic vision. And then there's just the part that's like, it's fun to be like Kermit, you know, and kind of run the Muppet show. Or I think a lot about James Cagney's character in Footlight Parade. Every phone is a different troop that's out and like a problem. Like the thing that's so funny, one of our films is rained out, they can't shoot anything, and he's like, well, if there's a rainstorm over there, why don't you get the like plate unit from another film that needs to shoot rain to put in the rear projection of a different movie, have them at least go to that rainstorm and shoot it, take this Tetris piece and put it over there so that it can like counterweigh this. Yeah,
it's a highly capable character as opposed to like Norville Barnes, who's like, turns out his crackpot idea is great, but also like he's sticking his foot in the garbage can and like kicking a flaming waste paper basket around the room. Here's a question. Is Eddie Mannix the most capable protagonist that they've ever written?
Eddie Mannix is very much like a much brighter version of the Gabriel Byrne character. He's not the guy directly in charge, but he has the ear of the big guy. So he's capable like Gabriel Byrne is. Other people that are similar are Marge or Tommy Lee Jones, or people that are not like at the head of their institution, but they're like very established and they know the code, they know who to talk to. And you see like if there's a problem, they put some pressure over here, they get a result. Whereas a character like High or Llewyn are just kind of flailing through the world and things are coming at them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Tommy Lee Jones is also like in the autumn of his years. As much as he has incredible instincts, like when he goes into that room, he knows that he's fucking dead if that guy's in there.
He's retired by the end of the film. Like he's no longer on the force.
Mannix is ready to keep fucking going.
Yeah. And he loves the Muppet Show. He's curmudgeonly and he's burned out on it. But ultimately it's like it's the same reason that anyone works on movies, is because like the rest of life is drab in comparison to something that is just so like hypercharged with silliness.
Good. Very good.
Good. Okay, so just at the end of looking at all those scenes, what do you think about setups at the end of this conversation that's new?
I think I went into this basically with the sort of thesis that in the Coen's work, there's a tension between plot and spectacle, and between like telling a story and like taking the audience on a ride that in one way or another is like not what they expected. But I think like with each one of those things that I kept calling a zag, we talked it out and we kind of came up with, I think, a pretty solid answer of like what that scene was doing narratively in like a more substantial way. I think I have a greater appreciation for like why those choices were made. And now I think that they are like contained within the like narrative logic of the films.
Right on. I feel like something that you've definitely brought my attention to that I had not thought about before this conversation that I'm really looking forward to tracking as we go forward is once you know what's going to be used later in the film, it's easy to go back and be like, oh, look, that's where it's set up. But often when something is established as a playing piece on the board, it's established among like two or three other things that are introduced with equal kind of underlining significance, like in the way that they're being presented to you. The goat cheese thing really does just drop off after that scene. But the gun is something that's being set up for the rest of the film. And it's like all those other guys that are in the sharing circle at the beginning of Raising Arizona do not show up over and over and over again through the rest of the film, but like Dale and Evel do. It like adds to like the kind of magic trick of when they show up again, because they really have been established. Like I'm just interested in seeing, as we're reading To the White Sea, what stuff is like a decoy and what is being laid down that is actually like, that is a full Chekhov's gun.
Totally. And you know what is something that I wanted to talk about in the reaction to the pages that I didn't talk about is just that when I read Red's dialogue, I just immediately think this guy's going to get killed and probably pretty soon. And I don't know if that's true or not because I haven't read any further than we are at in the story. But my feeling is that like this person that he's sort of pretending not to care about is highly vulnerable in the situation that he's about to get thrown into. In a way that like you would feel about like Haley Steinfeld in True Grit.
This is what's cool about doing this incrementally in slow motion, is that we can actually talk to you about tension as you're experiencing it. Whereas this is what you're feeling. You're feeling a kind of magnetic itch around this Red character just because of the way he's being positioned and kind of what you know is coming in terms of the bombing raid, right? Like, you know that there's going to be action in this story. They've talked about it.
Yeah.
And so there's something in you that's being like, I feel like that playing piece is like, right, it's like it's got like a magnetic pull on it towards a story suggestion. But like the pleasure will be, because I've sat next to you in movies and you, like when we watched Top Gun Maverick together, you would like literally be like, he's about to take the rule book and throw it in the, like, it's like, this is the rule book. And you were just like, throw it in the trash. And it cuts to like a low angle and he throws in the trash. You get into rhythm with movies just in terms of what they're setting you up for.
And I hadn't even seen Top Gun 1. How was I able to predict that?
Right. That's the game, right? Like that's the fun of the game. And so I really want to track that into The White Sea. What is pleasurable about something getting set up and then it falling down and it's a decoy? And what is pleasurable about something slyly being introduced into the story? And then like, maybe it's like the magnitude of how it pays off, or just, it's just that it's unexpected. Maybe that's it. It may or may not pay off big, but when it does pay off, it always pays off in a way where it is coming at you from an angle that you didn't expect. The magic trick of the reveal is like the most electric possible.
Yeah.
Maybe?
Yeah. Payoff. Setup.
Well, I'd love to understand that better by finding it when it appears in the pages coming forward.
Till next time.
That's good, right? For out? Okay. Do you have a...
What was the big reveal, Ray? The future.
Do you want to do it now or do you want to punt it to next time?
We said there was going to be a big reveal in this episode, but you know what it is.
Okay.
You want to give a hint?
I'll tell you right now. And then maybe we can recap it at the head of the next one.
Okay.
No, I'm sorry. We got to punt it.
Why?
I mean, do you have energy for a reaction right now, or do you think you're just going to have a sedated reaction?
Press 1 if you want us to hold it until next week. Press 2 if you want Ray to tell you right now.
Okay, so here's... Imagine a train going down the track, right?
Yeah.
And what if I told you there was some sections of this track that were missing? that's the situation we're in, that there are multiple pages of the screenplay missing.
Is that true?
This is true.
Da da da. That was To the White Sea. Episode 4, pages 7 through 8.
We're not talking about this until the next record.
Okay.
We're just not going to mention this.
We'll leave it here. We'll talk about it next time.
We're not talking about this in the time in between records.
Okay, we won't. Promise. To the White Sea is produced by Jordan Fish and Ray Tintori.
Starring Griffin Newman as Lieutenant Muldrow, Mike Sparra as Arlen, and Austin Purnell as Red.
Production support provided by Ben Hosley and Ike Sreeskandaraja.
To the White Sea theme music, written and performed by Dan Romer.